5 Hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Syria says it's broken the siege of a key airbase. Syria's military reports it has taken back a northern airbase that was under siege by Islamic State fighters for 2 years. Speaking by phone, the commander of the Kuiris Air Base in Aleppo, Major General Munthir Zamam, saluted his soldiers, who he says remained steadfast during the ordeal. Meanwhile, Moscow says it wants a second round of talks on Syria to focus on a list of terror groups operating in the country. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says any future ceasefire will not apply to terrorist organizations. In Washington Tuesday, U.S. spokesman Mark Toner announced Secretary of State John Kerry would deliver a major speech on Syria Thursday.
This is, I think, an effort by the Secretary to lay out in very concrete terms what we're trying to do, what our strategy is, what we're looking to accomplish. Now, there may be new elements in that, but that's, I think, the overarching goal.
Mr. Kerry will take part in a second round of talks on Syria's future Saturday in Vienna. A senior U.S. diplomat Tuesday urged the government of Burundi to begin internationally mediated talks with the opposition to end the country's political crisis. Tom Perriello, the U.S. envoy to the Great Lakes region, spoke Tuesday in Bujumbura.
It is crucial for all parties to respect their commitments, to join an internationally mediated dialogue with no preconditions and without delay. This is the only viable way to return Burundi to the path of peace and prosperity. The international dialogue will complement the inter-Burundian dialogue, thereby increasing the likelihood of success.
Meanwhile, a UN human rights official warned Tuesday that Burundi's violence threatens to spiral into an ethnic or regional conflict. More than 200 have died, tens of thousands have fled the country since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced his bid for re-election. This is VOA News. 2 weeks of relative calm in Jerusalem came to a violent end Tuesday when two Palestinians were killed, one wounded, during stabbing attacks against Israeli security members. 12 Israelis and 77 Palestinians have been killed in a wave of violence that began in September. Here in Washington, Israel's visiting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Tuesday that any two-state solution with Palestinians, Israel must maintain security over territory that it gives up.
Any deal or any arrangement, unilateral or negotiated, must have Israel maintain the ability to defend itself by itself against any threat, including from territories that are ceded.
He said the responsibility for a peace deal is on Palestinian shoulders, took aim at what he called the persistent Palestinian refusal to recognize the Jewish state. Russia says air links with Egypt will remain cut for months over security concerns at Egyptian airports in the wake of the October 31 plane crash in the Sinai Peninsula that killed all 224 people aboard a Russian Metro jet. A Kremlin spokesman said Cairo must improve security at the Sinai Resort of Sharm el-Sheikh, Cairo, and the Red Sea Resort of Hurghada, the cause of the crash under investigation. A strong 6.9 magnitude earthquake struck late Tuesday on the coast of Chile at a shallow depth of some 10 kilometers, about 460 kilometers northwest of the capital, Santiago. The same area was hit by an 8.3 magnitude quake in September. A Kenyan journalist was detained, questioned, and reportedly released on Tuesday by police over an article about corruption in the Kenyan Interior Ministry. Senior reporter John Gerachu of the Daily Nation newspaper was asked to reveal his source for the story on rampant spending within the ministry. John Githongo is a prominent anti-corruption campaigner.
This is the most corrupt Kenya has been since we started measuring corruption in the 90s. And I've been involved in this area for almost 20 years. This is the worst it's ever been.
The Daily Nation report was published after a Kenyan parliamentary committee released its own investigation into the expenditure of more than $37 million by the Interior Ministry in one day. The U.S. ambassador has called corruption a crisis in Kenya, which is undermining, he said, the country's future. European and African leaders meet on Malta Wednesday to discuss ways to stem the flow of migrants and refugees from Africa to Europe. Eritreans make up the bulk of nearly 140,000 who arrived in Italy from Africa by sea so far this year. The European Union says its asylum processing is so clogged with foreign migrants seeking refuge, it could take a year to process all pending applications if the migrant influx stopped immediately. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter got good news Tuesday. Doctors say there's no evidence his liver and brain cancer has spread and say the president is responding well to treatment. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. calls for dialogue to end Burundi's deteriorating political crisis.
The U.S. government believes that a comprehensive, inclusive dialogue, as laid out in the AU's October 17th communique, remains the best means of restoring peace and stability at this time.
Thomas Perello is the U.S. Special Envoy for Africa's Great Lakes region. A United Nations official says Burundi is heading down a slippery slope. The ICC assesses the health of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo ahead of his trial. And Nigerian President Buhari inaugurates his long-awaited cabinet today, Wednesday.
After the swearing-in, the president will now allocate responsibilities or assign each of these 36 ministers to various ministries and departments of government that they are supposed to serve.
Professor Kabiru Mato is the director of the Political Science Department of the University of Abuja. The UN World Food Program expands school feeding in Guinea-Conakry, and aid agencies resettle people in the Democratic Republic of Congo like agricultural tools and seeds. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The U.S. Special Envoy for Africa's Great Lakes region, Thomas Perello, says the U.S. is gravely concerned about what he calls the deteriorating political crisis in Burundi. Speaking Wednesday in the Burundian capital, Bujumbura, Mr. Perello also said the U.S. is hopeful that Burundi can rediscover a path to peace and shared prosperity. He also expressed U.S. concern about inflammatory rhetoric on both sides that he says encourages divisions among Burundians.
The United States is alarmed by the violent and incendiary language used by the Burundian government, as well as the violence by security forces and security personnel by anti-government actors. We are concerned by the use of violence on both sides, and we're concerned about rhetoric that encourages division, whether that's of political or ethnic nature. Rhetoric and actions that incite division and violence, whether here or abroad, is being watched carefully by the international community. It is crucial for all parties to respect their commitments, to join an internationally mediated dialogue with no preconditions and without delay. This is the only viable way to return Burundi to the path of peace and prosperity. The international dialogue will complement the inter-Burundian dialogue, thereby increasing the likelihood of success of both. The United States reiterates its vigorous support to restart the regional dialogue amongst Burundian stakeholders under the leadership of Ugandan President Museveni, as outlined by the East African Community and the African Union. The U.S. government believes that a comprehensive, inclusive dialogue, as laid out in the AU's October 17th communique, remains the best means of restoring peace and stability at this time.
Mr. Perello also expressed U.S. government's concern about what he calls the repressed state of the media and civil society groups in Burundi. He called for the immediate reopening of all independent media and assurance of protection for all Burundian journalists.
When I was here 3 weeks ago, I noted that the U.S. government is deeply disturbed by the repressed state of the media and civil society in Burundi, and highly concerned for the safety of all journalists. Since then, several more journalists have fled due to harassment, including a Voice of America stringer. Several others have been jailed just in the past week, including one from Radio Isanganiro, who is still in custody after his arrest on Saturday. A vibrant and independent media is an indispensable prerequisite of democracy, and we call for the immediate reopening of all independent media and assurance of protections for Burundian journalists. The world is now watching what happens here in Burundi with even more intense scrutiny and at even more senior levels.
Thomas Perello is the U.S. Special Envoy for Africa's Great Lakes region. He spoke Wednesday in the Burundian capital, Bujumbura. UN human rights officials have called the deteriorating political situation in Burundi explosive, and they warn that the Central African country is slipping down a very ugly slope. The United Nations is urging that greater international pressure be put on the government to stop the violence and prevent a regional conflict from breaking out. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Until now, the situation in Burundi mainly has been a political crisis. Observers say President Pierre Nkurunziza, who won a disputed third term in July, is determined to do whatever it takes to remain in power. UN human rights officials say they worry that this situation could rapidly turn into an ethnic as well as a regional conflict. Scott Campbell is chief of the Central and West African section of the UN's Human Rights Office. He says recent statements by Rwanda's President Paul Kagame invoking that nation's 1994 genocide show his concern about Rwanda being drawn into the Burundi crisis. Campbell says growing violence and human rights abuses since April, when Nkurunziza declared he would run again, have forced 280,000 people to flee their homes. He says 200,000 have gone to Tanzania, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
In DRC, there are refugee camps very close to the border, a number of kilometers from the border between Bujumbura and the Uvira area, housing refugees. But we have very serious concerns that these camps are being used as both recruitment ground for armed groups, but also by the Burundian authorities to identify opponents and threaten and intimidate them.
The United Nations documented 510 human rights violations last month in Burundi, including 55 extrajudicial killings, up from 40 in September. Campbell says he blames security forces and allied militia groups. He says there were 52 documented cases of torture and around 400 cases of arbitrary arrests and detentions in October. He also says more international pressure must be brought to bear upon Burundi's president to prevent the spread of violence. Campbell is urging the UN Security Council to take strong action that could include sanctions, freezing individual assets of those who incite or engage in violence, and travel bans. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Aid agencies say there is a need to find long-term solutions for nearly 200,000 displaced people who are living in camps in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Three camps were closed in the North Kivu province last month, and as Nick Long reports from the provincial capital Goma, there are likely to be more closures despite continuing insecurity in some areas.
The great majority of the estimated 700,000 displaced people in North Kivu are not living in camps and not receiving food aid. Nevertheless, donors are getting tired of paying for the more than 50 camps in the province, says Ben Adua, a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration in North Kivu. The donors have been funding the same things for a long time and funds are getting short, he told reporters. Part of the reason for donor fatigue is the realization that the number of people in the camps was exaggerated. Last year, after nighttime checks were carried out at 31 sites in North Kivu, the numbers at those sites were found to be two-thirds lower than initial estimates, according to a joint report by the organizations managing the camps in North Kivu. Some of that reduction would have been due to improved security, enabling people to return home, but the report clearly suggests that another reason was inflated figures. This year, five camps near Goma have been closed, and the people there have mostly returned to their home villages or resettled in areas near Goma. VOA spoke to a formerly displaced person, Jean-Pierre Havugimana, who left the Lac Vert camp near Goma last month and returned to his village, Kimoka. He told VOA he's very happy to be back home because people did not eat well at the camp and washing was difficult, whereas life is much better in his village. He adds that he wants to thank the organizations who help the returnees, but they also need tools like machetes and hoes, as well as seeds for farming. His neighbor, Faraka Songo, is vice president of the group of people from the Lac Vert camp who have moved to Kimoka. She tells VOA she and her family were promised seeds that have not yet arrived, and that makes life difficult for them because they depend on agriculture for their food. The seed distribution is the responsibility of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and was supposed to have happened by the middle of last month. Ben Adua of the International Organization for Migration told VOA it's been delayed. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Today's Wednesday, November 11th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya, Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda, Cameroon, and our VOA frequency station in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari will today, Wednesday, inaugurate his much-awaited 36-member cabinet, nearly 6 months after he himself was sworn in. The anticipation is high because up till now, and although the Senate has approved all 36 nominees, no one knows which portfolio each of the ministers will be assigned. Professor Kabiru Mato is director of the Political Science Department of the University of Abuja. He says Nigerians are anxious to know who will occupy some of the key cabinet posts, including finance, foreign, and especially whether the president himself will make good on his plan to take over the oil ministry, which accounts for nearly 70% of all Nigerian government revenue, but had been plagued in the past with corruption.
After the swearing in, the president will now allocate responsibilities or assign each of these 36 ministers to the various ministries and departments of government that they are supposed to serve. And after the portfolios are assigned, then the president said he is going to have his first national executive or federal executive council meeting.
Professor, according to what you're saying, Nigerians probably do not know which individual is going to be in which ministry.
Well, Nigerians do not know that at the moment because the president did not submit the list of the nominees, you know, assigned with the proposed portfolios to the Senate of the Federal Republic when he sent in the names for confirmation. And Nigerians, therefore, are free to speculate that likely Mr. A or Mrs. B is going to A or is going to B or so on and so forth. But the truth of the matter is that it's only today that Nigerians will know who the ministers, what their portfolios eventually are.
Professor, it's taken almost 6 months since President Buhari was inaugurated. We spoke about a month ago to Garba Shehu, the president's communication person, and he said that the selection process has taken this long because President Buhari, unlike previous administrations, has high expectations of his cabinet. If that is true, what are some of the key cabinet appointments that you think Nigerians should be watching out for, particularly given what Shehu Garba has said?
What the presidential spokesman said is right, but I think more important to that was what the president said on his 1st October speech, that the delay in the appointment of ministers had to do more with the inability of this government to acquire, you know, credible information from the government that just left. Another very important thing is, of course, the issue of the caliber of personalities that have been appointed ministers vis-a-vis the new direction of government, which desires to bring change. And bringing change, therefore, here means changing the ways of doing government business in Nigeria, breaking away from a past that has been characterized by massive corruption, impunity, and disrespect of law, order, and procedure. So whoever the president nominated and confirmed by the Senate, it is assumed that it's going to be an agent of change. It's also going to play a very credible role in ensuring that Nigeria is no longer run in a manner of business as usual, where people who are appointed into such, you know, lofty cabinet positions are only there to serve their personal interests and aggrandizement as against providing their skills, entrepreneurship, and expertise in moving the nation forward.
Professor Mato, is there likely to be a minister for petroleum resources?
The president's body language seems to suggest that he is going to appoint a minister of state for petroleum while he sits in as the overall supervisor of the petroleum sector. I think that could be, of course, a very wise decision based on the fact that he desires to put some very tight control measures in the way and manner the national resources or the resources that are accruing to the nation from the sale of oil, which, of course, constitute more than 70 to 80% of the total income of the country. I think it's a decision that we Nigerians will wish to give the president the benefit of the doubt to see how much he runs it, how much he controls this, you know, obvious economic crisis that we see from that sector in the next few years.
Professor Kabiru Mato is director of the Political Science Department of the University of Abuja. He was speaking with me from the Nigerian capital. The International Criminal Court, the ICC, is holding a two-day hearing on the health of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo, whose trial in The Hague is being postponed until January next year. Lisa Bryan has more for VOA from Paris.
Former President Laurent Gbagbo and Ivorian militia leader Charles Blé Goudé were both supposed to stand trial at the International Criminal Court on Tuesday. Instead, the court is holding a closed hearing as experts testify about Gbagbo's health. ICC spokesman Fadi Al-Abdallah explains.
The defense of Mr. Gbagbo asked the ICC judges to allow the defense and the other parties and participants to put questions to these experts. So that's basically what will be happening during this 2 days hearing.
Both Gbagbo and Blay Goudé face crimes against humanity charges linked to Ivory Coast post-election violence in 2010 and 2011. About 3,000 people were killed after Gbagbo refused to concede defeat to election winner Alassane Ouattara. In the past, Gbagbo's lawyers have questioned his fitness to stand trial, but spokesman El Abdallah says the possibility of cancelling the proceedings, which are now set to open January 28th, is not under discussion. That will make Gbagbo the first former president to face justice at the ICC. The court also tried unsuccessfully to bring his wife Simone to trial.
The fact that Gbagbo is in The Hague, I think, speaks volumes about the potential for international justice.
Parampreet Singh is senior counsel for Human Rights Watch's International Justice Program. While Gbagbo's trial is a coup for the court, she says, there is a lingering sense in Ivory Coast that the ICC's justice has been one-sided.
There were forces loyal to President Ouattara who also committed crimes, and they haven't yet been pursued by the ICC.
Ouattara, who was re-elected last month, has promised to bring perpetrators of the election violence to justice. ICC spokesman El Abdallah says the court's prosecutors are continuing to probe allegations against both sides. The court will take action, he said, once there's sufficient evidence to merit doing so. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Schools in Guinea are reopening this week after the summer break, and with the Ebola crisis still hurting many of the country's most economically vulnerable, the UN World Food Programme is expanding its school feeding program. The agency says more than 240,000 children in Guinea will receive school meals this year through the expanded distribution. Elizabeth Farr, WFP's country director in Guinea, tells Ricky Stryak that the program has grown from providing food to 735 last year to 1,605 primary schools this school year.
The schools are reopening after the summer holidays. It's extremely good news for Guinea, and at the World Food Programme, we're supporting the effort of attracting children back to school through our school meals programme.
How essential is the school meals programme, especially in light of this recovery from the Ebola outbreak, because the outbreak significantly impacted farmers' livelihoods, but also access to markets and other people's livelihoods. So I'm assuming WFP is finding that more people are food insecure in Guinea than before the outbreak.
Yes, we have found that it's been a significant impact on the agriculture sector. There are a number of extremely vulnerable communities who have suffered either directly or indirectly as a result of the Ebola outbreak. So one of our responses in terms of how to support communities to get back on their feet and recover from this crisis is to expand the school meals program. The school meals are basically in areas where there are high rates of food insecurity and malnutrition, where the primary school enrollment rates are particularly low, and the expansion that we're doing right now is in areas that have suffered from the Ebola epidemic. So we're finding that those are the communities where people are particularly vulnerable and where they need that extra support. And school meals provides a safety net, a necessary safety net. So it's vulnerable families, it helps boost school enrollment, it helps boost retention rates and achievement rates in school, and particularly for girls. And since a number of the canteens are being supplied with locally produced food, there's also an impact on the local farmers in terms of boosting production, boosting income, and really helping create a school meals program that is community-based and community-driven.
I know part of WFP's program is not just providing meals at school for all the students, but to provide take-home rations to girls who attend school regularly. Why does WFP single out girls in this way? Are they more vulnerable for attendance, and how?
Yes, definitely. We're seeing that girls are particularly vulnerable. They make up 3/4 of the number of children who are not currently attending primary school in Guinea. And the take-home rations that we provide, we're providing those to all the girls at school based on the girl's attendance. So if a girl is attending regularly, then she receives her take-home ration. So it's a conditional support. And it acts as a strong incentive for the girls to stay in school It also acts as a kind of barrier to early marriage and other dangers associated with early pregnancy. What we're seeing is that the girls who stay in school longer are more likely to lead healthy lives themselves, able to provide for their families in the future, and therefore contribute strongly to reducing education and security. I would like to point out this expansion in the beginning of the World Food Programme school meals activities has been made possible by basically a very generous contribution from USAID.
That was Elizabeth Farb, WFP Country Director in Guinea. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Conakry, Guinea. It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenyan world javelin champion Julius Yego is the only African among nominees in field events for the 2015 World Athlete of the Year Award. Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge, winner of the 2015 London and Berlin marathons, is nominated in the road running category. Among women nominees are Ethiopians Genzebe Dibaba and Mare Dibaba, the world 1500 meter and marathon champions, respectively. These nominees received the highest vote in their categories. The World Athletics Body, IAAF, revealed in Monaco. The nine categories were in sprints, hurdles, jumps, middle and long distance events, road running, race walking, throwing, multi-terrain, as well as combined events. Now a panel of 10 experts, with one drawn from each of the world's six continents, will further whittle down the nominees to three men and three women to be announced early next week. Turning to football, Mozambique host Gabon in Maputo as Sudan welcomes Zambia in Khartoum in the second round of the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifiers today, Wednesday. In volleyball, the Confederation of African Volleyball President Amar Elwani has named the Republic of Congo and Cameroon as hosts of the Africa 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympic Volleyball qualifiers. According to Elwani, the men's qualifiers are in Brazzaville from the 7th to the 14th of January next year, while the women's event is in Yaounde from the 12th to the 19th of February next year. The winner of each event automatically qualifies for the Olympics. In golf, the three-day Rwanda Open Golf Championship starts in Kigali today, Wednesday. It is seen among golfers as a tune-up for the East Africa Golf Challenge due to start in Kigali next week. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, November 11th.
The high cost of fuel, over 120 naira per liter now, has seriously affected the price of essential commodities that have become unaffordable for a common man. Marketers should therefore be compelled to reverse the government approved price of 87 naira per liter. Prince John Shear Obanuku in Obudukate Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And that is it for this Wednesday, November 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butte saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is facing his toughest challenge yet. Join host Shaka Ssali and his guests as they explore the possibility of major opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Dr. Kizza Besigye, joining forces in next year's Ugandan poll. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. On VOA